Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Okay, so here's the backstory. About a year ago, Massimo Piattelli and I should say the reason for the combination. Massimo knows something about biology and I don't. Massimo and Piattelli and I teamed up to give an argument for a claim that we both thought was probably right, though for some different reasons, somewhat different reasons. The claim is that theory of natural selection hereinafter TNS is inherently flawed, and that on very weak empirical assumptions, in fact, empirical assumptions that are known to be true, it can't be fixed. I should say at the start that this is an attack on TNS, which is a rather limited, highly articulate, compact theory. It's not an attack on evolution. Evolution has all sorts of significant claims, like, for example, that speciation represents a tree or something of that kind, is represented by a tree. All sorts of claims that have nothing to do with TNS, except at one crucial point, that is that TNS, it purports in the Darwinian and neo-Darwinian traditions to give the mechanism by which evolution works. Okay, so evolution does various kinds of things, including what will be important for us, the fixation of phenotypic traits. And one might well ask, well, how does it go about doing that? It goes about doing that because the mechanism of the theory of natural selection, the mechanism imported in the theory of natural selection, is up and running. So it's perfectly possible to have one's doubts about the theory of natural selection. It's even possible to have the suspicion that the theory simply doesn't work, and not have any problem with evolution or with we all used to be paramecia or something of that kind. I'm taking that whole story as common ground among civilized people. And I'm not going to argue about. I have no interest in creationism. I have no interest in God. I have no interest in any of that stuff. I'm interested in a straightforwardly, I take it, scientific question, namely, does the theory of natural selection account for the facts about phenotypic trait fixation? Okay, I'm going to make a couple of assumptions, which I think aren't tendentious before I get to the part that's violently tendentious. The two assumptions I care about, and again, here, raise your hand if you think there's something wrong with them. The first is that the question TNS wants to answer is the one that I just mentioned. Why do creatures have the phenotypic traits that they do? That's the sort of ur question. You find a phenotypic trait, you find one of these funny animals that biologists talk about, and you say, gee, this is a funny animal. How come it has 400 eyes? And the answer is, well, some story that fits the general pattern of TNS will show you that having 400 eyes rather than 412 or 2 or something of that sort is a good thing in the ecology in which this animal lives out its life. So the question is, how come is it that creatures have the phenotypic properties that they do, traits that they do? And the answer is, roughly, phenotypic traits are selected for. Phenotypic traits are selected for being causes of fitness. Okay, so if you find me a phenotypic trait on a certain kind of organism in a certain kind of ecology, and you ask me how come it's that we got that trait in this kind of organism in this ecology rather than some other trait, the answer is going to be that the former but not the latter, or the former but not as much as the latter, is a cause of fitness in that kind of organism in this kind of ecology. I take it that's untendentious, unless somebody thinks I've just misunderstood the Darwinian tradition, which is perfectly possible. But I take it that's essentially untendentious, And I take it also to be untendentious that if there is such a process, there must be a mechanism that performs it. So it's a test on the theory of natural selection, or really any other scientific theory, that there must be some way, at least in principle and preferably in practice, of constructing a mechanism, a piece of matter, such that given the way that mechanism is constructed and the environment in which it operates, it will in fact produce the distributions that the theory talks about. So non-mechanical examples, non-mechanical answers to the basic question, how come organisms have the phenotypic traits they do, non-mechanical answers are not allowed. So one thing that's not allowed is you're not allowed to say it's a miracle. And another thing that's not allowed is you're not allowed to say it's a creature of, it's a consequence of divine intentions. But another one is you're not allowed to say, well, it's got to be done somehow, but I have no story. In fact, I can't even conceive of a story about how it's done. So we want these to be mechanical theories in some appropriate sense of mechanical. No ghosts, no miracles, none of that stuff. Okay, so we have this argument, Massimo and I do, which is that, as I think I said, on very, very weak empirical assumptions, that, in fact, assumptions that are patently true, there can't be a mechanism that performs the processes that acts, that runs through the processes that Darwin thinks that the theory, that or that the theory of natural selection thinks that evolution depends on. So there's got to be something wrong with the theory. Okay, that's going to be the form of the argument. As you can see, at least as far as I can see, there's nothing tendentious in anything that I've just said. Everybody thinks that Darwin is committed to some sort of selectionist account of trait fixation. Everybody thinks that he's committed to mechanism, and so on. So this is all just common background. Okay, so we got an argument, and it's a very, very simple argument that says that given that background of desiderata, there's got to be something wrong with the Darwinist theory. Here's the argument. Maybe I should start out by saying this. We start with the assumption already mentioned that if a trait is selected, call it T1. Trait T1 is selected, then it's selected for a certain of its properties, namely it's a cause of fitness. Now, there's all sorts of complications and elaborations and brokennesses that you can put into this, and I don't care how it goes. For example, I don't care what fitness is, and I'm quite content that we should say it's something like reproductive efficiency, or if you want it to be mean number of hours survived, or so that's okay with me too. Just as long as it's something we can compare relative fitness. And just so long as there can be causal relations between having the phenotypic property T1 and having some increment in fitness that would not have been available to the creature, the creature would not have had if it didn't have T1. Notice that I'm not denying, in fact, I'm asserting, I'm jumping up and down on the assertion that phenotypic traits actually do cause fitness. There's a matter of fact about whether phenotypic trait TI is a cause of a certain variation in fitness, and that's, you know, that fact is available to God. It's not an epistemological fact about us. It's not a construct or something, just a fact, right? Some traits cause fitness and some don't, and TNS is the view that it's being a cause of fitness that responds, that is, that explains trait fixation, phenotypic trait fixation. Another thing I don't care about is how that works. I just assume that it does. Okay, so that's all right, and I think it's untendentious so far, but now consider the following case. There are two phenotypic traits, and they're linked. What I mean is, so here's a linkage. What I mean is that any creature, any phenotype, that contains T1 contains T2, and to make it maximally transparent, assume that's biconditional. So you get T1 if and only if T2. That plays no central role in the argument. It just makes it easier for the exposition. Okay, so here are these two traits, and they're linked. One, namely T1 in this case, is a cause of fitness, and T2 is neutral in this respect. It's causally, let's say, linked to T1, but it's neutral in its effect on fitness. Okay. What's the Darwinian story? Well, the Darwinian story is there's going to be a mechanism, and for reasons I'll mention, it's a mechanism which Darwin thinks of as largely exogenous, and this is not, as it were, this is not a dispensable addendum to the theory. It's something that's very central for reasons I'll come to later. There's a mechanism, and it's largely, at least, exogenous, some system of selectors that in this situation reaches in or out, or however you want to look at it, and grabs T1 rather than T2. And so it's in virtue of the behavior of this mechanism that T1, which is a cause of fitness, is preferred to T2 and ends up in the phenotype, though T2 doesn't. Remember, the general thesis that we're trying to evaluate is that the defining property selection is that it grabs properties in virtue of there being causes of fitness. That's what selection is for. Merely being linked to causes of fitness isn't good enough. Broaden the theory to say, well, it's not just being a cause of fitness, it's being somehow connected to a cause of fitness, then the power of the theory to say what can be and what can't be in a phenotype dissipates, right? It depends on what kinds of connections there are between phenotypic traits, and we have every reason to believe that there are all kinds. One is, the simple one that I'm talking about is the case where there's some sort of genetic commonality or something which guarantees that the traits come together, but there are millions of reasons. In fact, this is a sort of part of the Evo-Devo credo. There are millions of reasons why organic factors of one or another, one kind or another, can determine that there are correlations between phenotypic traits, and that these correlations can hold even if one but not the other is generates increments of fitness. Okay, so that's the picture, and what we want to argue is that there's no mechanism that will perform this trait, and that there are at a more reasonable estimate good reasons for thinking you couldn't have a mechanism that performs this this function. Okay, here's the story. First thing to notice is that whatever this mechanism does in producing the causal relations which lead to the selection of this one over this one on the grounds of the T1 but not T2 being a cause of fitness, however that thing works, what it's doing is not just causing T1 to become, it's not just a cause of T1 becoming phenotypic, it's an intentional cause of T1 becoming phenotypic. That is, what we've got, if Darwin's right, is a paradigm case of intentional causation. And that's, I think it's very easy to believe, in fact I always did, that intentional causation is really very special stuff. In fact, you only get it in psychology. So, but it turns out that it's playing a central role in biology too, if the Darwinian story is right as I have sketched it, and the question is how there can be intentional causation of this kind. What does it mean to say that it's intentional causation? Well, just that it's causation that can select between coextensive traits. So we're assuming that T1 and T2 are linked. So we're assuming that if an organism has T1, then it has T2, and vice versa. So we're assuming that anything that chooses between them right? Must be the kind of thing which does not require coextension, which does not treat coextensive traits as equivalent. Okay? So this is just what coextension always means, right? It's not an intentionality, always means. That is, suppose this is the trait of having long ears and this is the trait of having a red nose. They come together. You get one or both. Both or none. And nevertheless, this mechanism Yeah, it's good. Okay. Let me stop at this juncture. Yeah.
It would be really helpful for me if you could do that with my frogs from the previous talk.
With what?
My frogs. So I've got my frogs where T1 is being noise proof and yeah. T2 is being silent.
Fine, yeah.
But presumably that's subject to this criticism, right?
No, but there hasn't been any criticism yet. I'm just sitting out what I take it the theory is required to do. It has often been said to me, and I must find, it was even said today, or said of me, that I hold that in this situation, that there's something infirm about this picture, that in this situation, there can't be a matter of fact about which is the cause of fitness, right? There's no epistemic accessibility to the answer to the question, which is the cause of fitness. I do not hold either of these things. In fact, if I did hold either of these things, the argument that I'm setting out would be useless, because I want to claim as against Darwin that his theory of how natural selection works provides no mechanism for making this kind of distinction. And that would be no objection unless this is a real distinction, right? It wouldn't be an objection to the Darwinian theory to say that it can't distinguish between coextensive properties if it turned out that there is no distinction between coextensive properties, right? This is only an objection if there really is a matter of fact about which of these two things causes fitness. And moreover, it's a matter of fact which is not by any respect epistemically inaccessible. It's not just that there's such a fact, but we can find it out, and we know perfectly well how we find it out. So, for example, here's one way you do it. Suppose these are de facto coextensive, as I say. Well, one way to tell which one is the one that's responsible for fitness is just to use the method of differences. This is just, you know, Phil 101. That is to say, you create a situation, an experimental situation, in which you get T1 but not T2. You bring about something in the experimental environment which doesn't happen in the, by assumption, doesn't happen in the real world. or one in which you get T2 rather than T1, and then you see whether you get the increment of fitness in either or both of these situations. The one which continues to increment fitness by a standard argument for method of differences is the one that is presumably, unless there's some reason to think otherwise, that is causing the increase in fitness in the non-experimental environment. This is nothing more. This is nothing deeper than the remark that if you want to know whether it's the alcohol in the drink or the ice cubes in the drink that's making you tipsy, you can run an experiment, and even on the assumption that in all the things you drink you get both or neither, you can run an experiment in which you get the alcohol but not the ice cube, and you could run an experiment in which you get the ice cubes but not the alcohol, and barring interaction effects, you will find out that you get the tipsiness in one case but not in the other, so that's the one that's the cause of fitness. This is just the everyday, standard, untendentious, uninteresting process of running a controlled experiment. There is, I will say it once more, because so many people think I'm lying when I say it, there is nothing in this argument which depends on saying that there's no fact of the matter about this being a cause of fitness and this not, or saying that there is a fact of the matter, but it's for some reason epistemically accessible. Nothing could be more transparent than this is. It's the kind of situation we find all the time. And what we do is, as I say, we appeal to counterfactuals. Fundamentally, I think what's going on here is we say, well, what would happen in a world in which you get T1 but not T2? What would happen in a world, what would have happened in this world if you got T2 but not T1? And you find out which situation continues to give an outcome of fitness, and that's the way you discover, that's the way you deconfound the variables, right? There's no ontological stuff up my sleeve. I don't think that there's no fact of the matter about which of confounded variables is the cause, and there's no epistemological stuff up my sleeve either. Okay, so all right so far? Anybody deeply unhappy? Good. We've got this method for deconfounding deconfounding linked variables, and presumably it works in this circumstance, and presumably we can, you know, work it if we want to run an experiment to find out which one of these, which way, as it were, God draws this diagram. Everything is above board and kosher so far. Question, can you get a mechanism which will do that job? If you can't get a mechanism that will do that job, Darwin's in trouble. If what is really going on is in natural selection is breaking of a confounding, right? Distinguishing which of two confounded variables is the one that has the causal powers, then there must be some mechanical way of doing it. That's independent of the fact that there must be some way for an observer to do it or a scientist to do it and so on. There must be some kind of mechanism that doesn't require ghosts and doesn't require God and doesn't require miracles and so on, such that you can construct it in the situation to choose this guy rather than this guy. If you can't do that, Darwin's in trouble. In fact, the theory of natural selection is just the claim that there is such a mechanism. Okay, so far. Could there be such a mechanism? There couldn't be. Let me put the relevant point in two kinds of ways. One way of putting it is, look, as far as anybody knows, if you want to break a coextension, right, if you want a mechanism that will break a coextension, it's got to be of two kinds. One is one that has access to laws that say, in a certain ecology or something, this one causes fitness and this one doesn't, or there's got to be a mind in it. As far as I know, those are the only bona fide examples of intentional selection seem to be at least compatible with some kind of naturalist story. So the reason minds are important is, suppose, remember that that Darwin took very seriously a putative analogy between artificial selection and natural selection. What goes on in artificial selection is that you get some guy, that there's a guy living in the mechanism, and he has certain intentions. He intends that the next generation of phenotypes should have this property but not this property. So he's got a goal in mind. And then he arranges things so that if it has this property, it will cause fitness, and if it has that property, it won't. And the arrangement that he imposes on the situation reflects what he's got in mind. So if you got a mind that is that has intentions about how the causal relation should go, now we don't know, nobody knows how that happens, of course, but it's a bona fide precedent for an intentional mechanism playing a role in causal explanation. The other possibility is if you have laws of the kind which say, as it might be, in environment T, T1s cause fitness and T2s don't. That might be a law of nature. The point about laws is that laws are intentional entities too. The nomological explanation, as opposed to punctate case-by-case causal explanation, is a case of intentional explanation. So if you had a law that connected the property of being T1 with causing fitness, say, in a certain ecology, and there's no law that connects the property of being T2 with being a cause of fitness in that ecology, then that would give you, then if this mechanism has access to that law, as it were, knows about that law in the various ways it might, then you could explain how these coextensive traits behave differently under the properties of under the processes of selection that this thing superintends. Okay, as far as I know, this is deeply puzzling. As far as I know, these are the only possibilities that have so far been invoked in serious scientific talk. You get obviously intentional psychology all over the intentional causation within sec all over the place in psychology. You get causation that involves appeal to covering laws of one sort or another all over the place, whether in psychology or not. And they're both they're both, as far as anybody knows, perfectly good ways of supporting a claim to be able to make a distinction between coextensive properties. But that's all, again, as far as anybody knows. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I mean intentional. So far, intentional with an S in every case except this one, and this is both S and T. It's intentional in the sense of no substitution of co-referring expressions, and it's also intentional in the sense that that it's beliefs and desires which have this property. Okay. There isn't any other story that I've heard about how you could get a mechanism which chooses between coextensive traits. How could this mechanism do so? Well, it's got evidence. What's the evidence available to it for making this choice? Well, it gets evidence. It gets basically evidence, correlational evidence, which it tries to parlay, which it wants to parlay into evidence of causation. So what's going on with this organism and what this mechanism has access to is that T1 correlates with fitness and is thus prima facie to be selected for. The trouble with that is that that's true of this too, right? Because they're linked. Any correlation between T1 and fitness entails a correlation between T2 and fitness and vice versa. So as far as the operation of this machine is concerned, it can't distinguish between this story, the one I've got on the board, and that story. Why? Well, just because of the linkage. That's another way of saying the same thing that I was saying before. In order to work, this thing is going to have to be intentional causation, intentional mechanism, not the usual, not usual extensional notions like cause. Yeah.
Help me out on what the mechanism is. I mean, I'm having some difficulty of mapping this very abstract picture to the kind of evolutionary story that you think will eventually not.
Well, it's hard to say because I think there isn't any mechanism that can do this. That's the worry. But what a mechanism would be a machine. You put the machine out in the backyard. The machine sees what's going on. It notices that there are correlations between the presence of T1 in a creature and the increment of fitness. And if it weren't that you also have that for T2, it would just say, okay, so presumably the increase of fitness is. I'm sorry? No.
A decision-making mechanism? Because you're saying it's looking at.
There's got to be something in the world. There's got to be some causal system in the world, according to Darwin. Look, this choice doesn't happen by miracle. There's got to be something in the environment or somewhere around.
We're talking about the mechanism by which selection is supposed to be implemented, not the mechanism by which an evolutionary biologist's decision.
Oh, no, this is the. Right, well, we're actually talking about both. It certainly isn't the biologist's decision that we're talking about. It is indeed part of his theory. The theory says when you get this kind of confounding, you can still hold on to the view that to be phenotypic is to be a cause of of fitness because you can assume there's a mechanism which decides, right, that this is a mechanism in the world, some engine working in the world that decides between T1 and T2. Right? So look, you got something. Here's something that the biologist is saying happens every day. There are these confounded traits. One of them is a cause of fitness, the other is not. So this one becomes phenotypic and the other doesn't. Okay? There's got to be some way that this works. Right? There's got to be some gadget or gizmo or whatever, such that in virtue of the operation of that gadget or gizmo, this thing becomes phenotypic and this thing doesn't. Right, that's part of the story about the world that Darwin is telling. Okay? Yes.
Maybe you put the mechanism in the wrong place. Maybe because you're making it sound like you need a dumb, purely mechanical mechanism that's going to choose what property this thing.
Yeah,
is
that's
have.
What I'm holding. That's exactly what I'm holding.
You could have a mechanism, namely the rough and tumble of the backyard. That determines whether you get to keep that characteristic that you have.
Yes, I was going to
or whether things like you get to stay around.
Right.
And you don't need intentionality for that.
Well, you need intentionality in a special sense. That is, that you need it to operate differently for coextensive traits, in the case of coextensive traits. You don't need mentality, but you need intentionality.
Well,
with an S.
But why?
Why?
It's the connection between the trait and fitness. That
what you're trying to do, wait, look, what you're trying to do is choose which one of these two is to become phenotypic, right? The story is you choose the one which is fitness increasing. So if there's any causal system in the world that actually makes such a choice, it must distinguish T1 from T2 precisely in that T1 is a cause of fitness and T2 is not. I mean, that's what Darwin says is going on, right? Now, you're quite right. It could be creatures growling at one another in the backyard or something. That's perfectly true. And I want to, at the very end, I'll come to that point. Yeah. That physical reality isn't the mechanism. Physical reality. If I say, look, here's I'm a theorist. Look, I'm sorry.
The aspects of physical reality which interact.
Sure, some sort of interaction.
Are self-executing.
Yeah, fine.
Some additional feature of the world.
Fine. Yeah, that's good. But you got to be able to say what those properties of the world are, such that because they're operating in this case, you get T1 as phenotypic and you don't get T2. This, I take it, is just banal. I mean, there's no.
Right, and that's the part of evolutionary biology, which is models and theories of selection pressures. Are those that specify
Yes, and I say you won't be able to do it because unless you can find an aspect of the physical world which is sensitive to intentional, non-extensional distinctions. That's the problem. So these two have the same extensions by assumption, but only one of them is a cause of fitness. So whatever the mechanism in the world is that chooses this one and says, no, it's not this one that's to become phenotypic, it's got to be sensitive to some sort of difference between these coextensive properties. Okay? I'm sorry?
And that's, so to make it clear with an example, for example, insects on small islands frequently lose their wings.
Whatever. As it might be. That would be fine.
So there you have a sort of basic principle of physics, you know, and basic that I'm sure you cleverly come up with an indefinitely large set of coefficients.
Right. That's a perfectly good mechanism I'm using the notion. So it could be any arrangement in the environment, including a computational arrangement in the environment, such that given a correlation between this and this, and a correlation between this and this, it says, it chooses, it doesn't say, it chooses this one is the cause of fitness and rejects that one. Okay, now there might be such a mechanism, but what I'm going to suggest is that there's a further constraint that Darwin wants to impose, or maybe I've already mentioned this, which is that this mechanism, that these selectors be in large part or solely exogenous. And if you add that constraint, the theory's not going to work. Okay? And you can see why. I mean, because the fact that make these things, the linkage, may well be endogenous. Right? So they're linked in the genetics or something of that sort. But exogenous selectors can't look at that kind of linkage, so they can't figure out, as it were, which of these two guys is the one that's causing fitness. If you could look at the flow of causation, as it were, through the organism, you could see first that these were linked. That's why if either of them is connected, correlated with fitness, both of them are. But you could also see that the path to the increment of fitness goes via T1 and not via T2, so everything would be fine. As long as some of the selectors are endogenous. If they're exogenous, or largely exogenous, then you can't use that, because exogenously, from the outside of the organism, these two situations look exactly identical. There's a correlation between fitness and T1, and there's also a correlation between fitness and T2, and the magnitude of the correlations is identical. Okay, that's basically the argument. Yes?
It's a law of nature on thermodynamic considerations that when it processes information, there will also be heat. And that's...
Right. That would be fine.
Endogenous. And I have a signal coming in, and I get an amplified version of the signal coming out.
Right.
Can't I, on physical grounds, think that the heat increase was not the pathway?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, why can't Darwin do that?
That's exactly the right... That's one of the exactly right things to say. And the answer is, remember, this story is supposed to be a piece of biology, not a piece of physics. So this story ought to be looking for exogenous factors at the biological level. Right, which are such that if they're in operation, you get a choice between these two. Otherwise, the whole theory is vitiated. I mean, the whole theory doesn't amount to a constraint. Why? Because there's going to be a physical connection for anything, any causal relation at whatever level. Right. So, of course, there's going to be some physical story about why this thing is the cause of fitness and this thing isn't. But that's not a story that you want to tell in your biology. Not unless you're inclined to say, well, biology just is, as they used to say, physics plus labels.
Suppose that we're in a situation where a change in color of a bird's feather reduces its vulnerability to predation. And suppose becoming darker happens to go with, suppose the mechanism happens to involve, incidentally, the eggshell changing color.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so T1 is having black feathers, and T2 is having an orange eggshell.
Yeah, right, and they're linked.
And as I understand it, you're claiming that I wouldn't be doing biology if I said that the selection went via the change in the change in feather color rather than the change of egg color because that's physical?
No. You wouldn't be doing biology because you'd be saying that the connection is determined by whether it's that what's being selected is egg color from beak color or something of that sort. If you're saying, oh, well, I'm interested in positron flow here as opposed to positron flow there, well, of course you're going to get an explanation. You got to get an explanation because every event is a physical event. The question in special science...
Predators don't look at the eggs, I'm imagining.
I'm sorry?
So the way in which selection takes place won't... Because we're imagining predation on adult birds.
Yeah.
The predation won't occur on the egg, so the change in egg color that's imagined is correlated in development with a change in bird color.
Right.
That plays no role in the way in which selection takes place.
So well, how does the correlation work? Hmm? I mean, how does it turn out that this thing gets selected? I'm not understanding the example. The predator selects, the predator goes after these things and doesn't go out after these things, so this thing causes fitness and these things don't. Okay, fine. That looks like a counterfactual supporting biological explanation. If you had those kinds of things, if it were the case that there were mechanisms that one could pick out, essentially counterfactual supporting generalizations of just the ones you have in mind, then fine, there would be a mechanism in this sense for choosing between these two, and there's no problem. All I'm saying is it can't satisfy the request for the demand for a mechanism that there be some mechanism specifiable in the vocabulary of physics. Right. This has got to be a biological story. Now, I mean, this is quite true in any of the special sciences. It's important for there being special science theories that the demand for mechanism be not satisfied at the physical level. Right. Because if it's satisfied at the physical level, then the explanation of why you get these two is a physical explanation and the biology drops out. Yeah.
Get back to the frogs because it's a real example, and following many years of having it beaten into me by David Hull, I think only real examples are worth discussing. I mean, you know, we've got a T1, we've got a T2,
right.
We've got a selection scenario that mentions T1, which is, you know, leg waving is detectable in noisy environments.
Fine.
And that's why it's great.
Yeah.
And it's also silent, and that's irrelevant, although you could imagine it was relevant, but
fine.
It isn't. You know, I'm just trying to get why it is that... So my biological generalization, which I'm appealing to, is on three continents in a couple of dozen cases, you stop using an auditory signal when you live in a noisy environment. And
yeah.
According to you, that's physics? That's not
Well,
physics.
Yeah, but that's not... In that case, that's not the objection. The objection is it's not general. See, look,
there's
there are two
three
things.
Continents and like two dozen species independently evolving this thing. That's
look, there
general.
Are two. No. Look, there are two kinds of problems that can arise in an attempt to meet this condition. One is that it's met only at the physical level, and it's obvious why you're not interested in that. Another is, however, that is that it's met in different ways for each case of adaptation. Right. So if it's an adaptation of color or color at a certain kind of bird, then there's one mechanism. If it's an adaptation of, I don't know, body size or something, then there's another. And what you don't get is what a theory of evolution is supposed to give you, namely what the common feature of all these cases is. Right. A theory of evolution is to say, supposed to say not only that this happens, but that in some reasonable sense, it's what happens when you get fixation of traits. Otherwise, it's not a theory of evolution. It's a theory. It's what it is, a sort of historical, geographical survey of how particular traits got fixed in particular phenotypes. Now, you can give those kinds of stories, right? And in fact, I think that's what much of the interest of evolutionary observations is. The question is whether or not you can put them all together, get something that satisfies this set of desiderata, and that... has the same story about selectors in the various kinds of cases. And I suspect the only way you can do that is in physics, if you can do it at all. Right. So remember, you got a number of desiderata, including the one that this is not just a theory, not just a historical story about how this creature ended up having this trait. It's supposed to be a theory of how traits are fixated. Right. The fact that you can tell a story in one case is of no particular interest unless you can tell the same story in another case. I take this to be another banal remark. I don't think there's anything tendentious about it. Yeah.
Jerry, I think things, I mean, I know you won't accept, I think I know why you won't accept this, but just let me try and take this one stage further. The way I always look at this is in the following way. If you classify traits using ecological categories, and yes, you've just pointed out that those will be unique, so right, it will be, you know, right, detectable in high ambient noise, versus if it's a camouflaged egg, it's going to be, you know, right, easily seen on, you know, right, against a background of guano droppings, right, or something, right? You can classify traits ecologically, and that'll plug you into locally valid ecological generalizations.
Right.
If you classify those traits, the only more abstract classification is classifying them simply as related via relative fitness functions to their competitors.
Yes.
So you're straight up into the math.
Then the theory is vacuous.
But in that case, it's not physics. I mean, the objection ought to be an objection that Elliot Sober often, you know, considers,
right,
which is the objection that the only, when you state selection theory at the level of generality you're demanding, it turns out to be a priori true.
Exactly.
In which case, I would give you Elliot's challenge, which is, what is wrong with a priori truth?
Nothing's wrong with a priori truth, but it's a bad idea, as in fact Mill found out. It's a bad idea to be an a priori truth masquerading as an empirical theory, right? And in fact, what you're suggesting, and this was the point I was going to end on, what you're suggesting is exactly what a number of commentators on the book suggested. Hold on. So what they say is, look, hello? Yeah, what they say is, look, the problem, there isn't any problem of the kind that Massimo and I were raising. Why isn't there any problem of that kind? Well, because I'm looking for something that connects being chosen, becoming phenotypic, with being a cause, with being selected, and that the features that cause fitness are selected, that generalization isn't supported by a mechanism. It's an analytic truth. This seems to me grotesque. For a number of different reasons, but I do want to convince you in the first place that that is what people say. So here's a quotation from a blog authored by Block and Kitcher. They say, since selection for is identical to having a differential effect on reproductive success, they're identical, they're not connected by a mechanism, they're just the very same thing. One might suppose that, say, in the moth case, Fodor and friend would have to accept that the dark color was selected for, whereas properties that are merely correlated with the dark color were not. I take it everybody knows this moth story. Yeah, okay. But, continuing, they say, we hedge this acceptance of the standard identification, for, we go on to say, Darwin needs an account of selection for that distinguishes phenotypic traits that cause fitness from phenotypic traits that are merely correlated with fitness, with causes of fitness. We, that is, Block and Kitcher, find their odd demand frustrating, for as the pertinent terms are used in evolutionary theory and biology, traits that cause fitness just are traits that are selected for. So it's a semantic fact that that if you're a cause of fitness, you're selected for. If you're not a cause of fitness, you're not selected for, and you don't need, in effect, a mechanism which tells you how the selection runs. Here's some more of the same. Fodor and Piattelli think that in order for dark color rather than some correlated trait to be selected for, there is need for a device that responds selectively to one rather than the other, and this is simply an eccentric invention. It is as if, having abandoned Mother Nature, we think that there has to be a mechanism to take the place of Mother Nature. But the job is done by causation itself. That phrase was used sometime yesterday. The job is done by causation itself. Dark color promotes progeny. No other mechanism is needed. Now, I do think that's crazy. Consider the following analogy. Here's a regularity. Incoming calls cause the ringer on my phone to ring. How does that work? Well, no problem, comes the answer. If incoming calls didn't cause the ringer to ring, it wouldn't be a ringer. Being a ringer and being caused to ring by incoming calls are interdefined. That being so, there doesn't need to be a mechanism that causes a ringer to ring in response to incoming calls. The job is, to quote, done by causation itself. No other mechanism is needed. Now, I take it that's crazy. It's true that if you're a ringer, then you ring for incoming calls. That's what a ringer is. It doesn't begin to follow that you don't need a theory of ringers. You don't need a theory which says, how is it that something which is sensitive to an incoming call is also a cause of ringing? That's what a ringer is. What you need, another way to put it, is you've got on this story, as analytic, some generalization of the form Fs or Gs, and the suggestion is you don't need an explanation of why Fs or Gs, so long as there's an analytic connection between the two. This is really, you know, going back to the 50s. It's the philosophy of biology tracking the philosophy of mind. So there was this guy, Gilbert Ryle, of whom many of you will have heard. Here's what Gilbert Ryle stumbled across a copy of Descartes one day and found Descartes saying, look, when you want your arm to raise, then cateris paribus, your arm goes up, right? Now, how could there be a causal link between the two? That, I think, is a very good question, but it's not one that Ryle undertook to answer. Why? Because he said, well, look, you don't need to answer that question. You don't need a mechanism. It's a logical truth, a conceptual truth, a semantic truth, or something of that sort, that when you want your arm to go up, then all else equal, your arm goes up. That won't fly, right? You can't replace a mechanistic explanation with a claim of analyticity. And the basic reason you can't is that if the underlying generalization is Fs or Gs, if that's the generalization that you're trying to explain, arm raisings are caused by wants to raise your arm and so forth and so on, it's perfectly true that you can't ask the question, you can't give a mechanistic explanation of why Fs or Gs. That would be like giving a mechanistic explanation of why bachelors are married, and that's exactly unmarried. And that's exactly the case Ryle has in mind. Right? So he says that you can't get that kind of explanation, so it's foolish to ask for it in this case. But of course that argument is no good. The argument is no good because what you can ask for is why aren't there things that are just like Fs except for not being Gs? Right? And that requires a mechanical explanation.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.